Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and I'm joined this week by Toby Lischtig, our fiction and politics editor, standing in for Lucy Dallas until next week. Toby, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anything, culturally speaking, that you would like to ring a bell for this week? A celebratory bell rather than a funeral knell, to be clear, although either, I suppose, could be quite interesting. Up to you.
There is, and I have a bell. How's that?
Oh my gosh.
Is that celebratory enough?
That was piercing.
Sorry about that. That was on my son's balance bike. The bell was being rung for My Phantoms, which is a new novel by Gwendolyn Riley, which I read last week. Now, it's not actually out till April, so I don't know whether this is, you know, useful.
This is a tease.
Or is it just a tease and an irritant to people who don't have their hands on a copy, as I am so lucky to have. It's brilliant. I love Gwendolyn Riley. I loved her previous book, First Love, and this is equally acerbic and witty and tender as well. It's about a relationship between a woman and her sort of woman in early middle age and her very difficult aging mother, kind of classic Gwendolyn Riley territory. They're both sort of doing this dance around each other. The mother's a bit needy, but also incredibly emotionally unavailable at the same time. And the woman, the narrator, is trying to sort of be a good daughter, but also perpetually infuriated by her. And it's written this very cool and spare and precise prose that Gwendolyn...
Well, that's what we expect of Gwendolyn Riley now, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was just, I just hoovered it up last week. I'm about to judge a literary prize, and a consignment of 23 books is arriving this afternoon. So this is my last kind of piece of pleasure reading until I get down to the serious work reading. So I think I particularly enjoyed it for that reason too. But actually, on its own terms, it's one of the best things I've read in a while. So
excellent. A worthy addition to the brilliantly twisted mother-daughter relationships of fiction then.
Exactly. Very, very much in that canon.
Excellent. Well, before we move on, I would also like to fill listeners in on something from this week's letters page. So last week, Lucy and I began the programme by talking about Sian Evans's new book, Maiden Voyages, Women and the Golden Age of Transatlantic Travel, in which it is noticed that when a woman gave birth below decks, after concealing her pregnant state, there might be a whip around among the rich on board. So one mother got £450, which is £13,000 in today's money, and another got a Ford car. The captain would register the birth, and on a British ship, the certificate would always say Stepney, which was intriguing. But then we got this letter from Bernard Richards in Oxford, and he offers a possible reason. I wonder, he says, if this is because attachable spare tyres on cars early in the century were known as Stepneys, after the street in Clonelly, where they were invented by Thomas Morris Davis and Walter Davis. The device was patented in 1904. And then he says, in chapter 11 of Howard's End, Charles Wilcox says to his chauffeur, "Now, Crane, just don't forget to put on the Stepney wheel." I don't suppose most modern readers have the foggiest idea what he's talking about. So really, I'm just offering listeners this as the apotheosis of a TLS letter. Thank you, Bernard Richards from Oxford. Coming up on this week's show, can a book make you a better person? Can even the high modernists be mined for lessons in life? Apparently so. Joanna Scutts will fill us in on the relationship between literature and self-help. To some, it's exhilarating, to others, troubling, to others, still profitable. But in all cases, it seems, it is complicated. And we check in on the debate still going on around the official Home Office history of Britain. Full of omissions and riddled with errors, it is a document of grave consequence and must not be ignored. But first, we will aim to do history right as we turn to Stalin, a man whose life, as our writer Stephen Lovell points out, is no stranger to distortion. Our review essay this week takes in two important biographies, the first of which, by Ronald Grigor Suny, shows us Stalin as a young man, all too human, while the second, by Evgeny Dobrenko, translated by Jesse Savage, gives us something altogether less real, a figure whose humanity is veiled by his mythical image as father of the Soviet nation. Stephen Lovell, Professor of Modern History at King's College London, joins us on the line now to help us reconcile the two. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
You describe reading these two books together as a disorientating experience. How so?
Yes, the main reason is that they leave out the main part of Stalin's career, or what's considered the main part of his career, from revolution to World War II. So we see the very young Stalin becoming a revolutionary up to 1917, up to the moment of the Bolshevik takeover in October 1917. And then we fast forward to Brunker's book, to the high Stalinist period, and very much a study of the of Stalinism rather than Stalin himself. So that's one disorientating thing about it. The other is that the books are so different from each other, because one is a biography and shows Stalin as close up as we can claim to see him. And the other is a study very much of Stalinist public discourse ideology. So, you know, very different approaches in the two books.
So let's start with the young Stalin then, when in fact that wasn't even his name. Who is this boy man, Ronald Grigor Sunny's subject? Who is he and what's he like?
Well, he's born Yusuf Djugashvili in Gori, a small town in Georgia, the son of a shoemaker. And it's a kind of normal upbringing on the periphery of the empire, I think you could say, in that he's born into the family of a, for a while, quite successful artisan. The father becomes an alcoholic and falls on hard times, slightly hard times, and moves to the city and leaves the family behind in due course. So there is a broken home, if you like, at a certain point in Stalin's adolescence. But what Sunni points out, and I think it's right, is that there's a lot more than kind of trauma and disruption and violence in this childhood, that there was also an inheritance of ambition that Stalin's mother in particular saw the way upwards for him through education and did what she could to get him a good start in life, that lay through church education in the first instance. And she had him lined up for the priesthood. Stalin, of course, had other ideas.
He goes to this seminary, doesn't he? The Tiflis Seminary, and yeah. you sort of allude to the fact that he might have been radicalised there in some sort of way. Is that a fair characterisation?
Well, he was undoubtedly radicalised there. Yes, it was a breeding ground really for young revolutionaries who formed their own study groups, in due course, Marxist study groups in the 1890s in the seminary. It was a pretty inflexible, despotic administrative regime in the seminary. So it's not surprising that it triggered this kind of reaction.
So they sort of rebelled against the regime in the seminary rather than being fostered by it in some way. It was a kind of
That's right. It was part of. I mean, there's various things going on here. I think overbearing regime in the seminary is part of it. Youthful self-assertion is another, and another is just simply the fact these ideas were out there. This was the intellectual air that ambitious young people on the margins of empire were breathing at that time.
So his background and education really created the perfect conditions for political success in a way. It sort of sets him up to become what Sunni describes as a man of the middle, which is an interesting and useful phrase, I think.
Yes, the thing that you keep coming across in both these books is that Stalin is very flexible and willing to be accommodating on occasion, but also capable of bold strokes at times. So this is a kind of line of connection you can draw between the two books, this flexibility, pragmatism. But at the same time, he does at certain points take risks, show real leadership. He earned his stripes in Georgia, in the Caucasus, starting in the late 1890s, by conducting propaganda in worker circles. In due course, he moved to Black Sea port city, Batumi, and was involved there in instigating a worker demonstration that was suppressed very bloodily in 1902. So he has all sorts of ups and downs. But, you know, reading Sunni's book, it seems to me the big formative event in his early life and you know, possibly in his life full stop, is the 1905 revolution, which is extremely violent and dangerous in the Caucasus and in Tiflis especially. And he's operating in all sorts of different ways. He's still a party journalist. He's still doing agitation. He's conducting a fierce fierce factional battles within the party, and he's leading an armed band.
And so, I mean, even in these early days, and presumably especially in 1905, this would have been coming to the fore, this propensity for intrigue that Stalin's critics noted. What was it that they were seeing? Is there a particular event or, you know, a particular anecdote that allows us to see what he was up to, for want of a better expression?
Well, I think that there are a number of little things. One big example that caused a stink in the party was the Tiflis heist of June 1907, where Stalin played evidently some kind of part in organising a robbery of two mail coaches in Tiflis, making off with, not Stalin personally, but the people who carried it out, making off with 250,000 rubles that turned out to be useless because the serial numbers could be traced. So that was just after the party decided that such things were not going to happen. So there's a sense that he can, you know, go off piste, do his own thing. And he's also a very, well, the positive way of looking at it would be to say that he's a very astute reader of other people. He does play people off against each other, which takes on very sinister implications later on in his life. But, you know, possibly to some extent is a prerequisite for any successful politician.
I'm thinking now of your own book, How Russia Learned to Talk, A History of Public Speaking in the Stenographic Age. What kind of speaker, what kind of communicator was Stalin? I mean, how did he develop those skills? How did he interact with changes in, say, public expectations or the technology?
Yes, so Stalin kind of figured a little bit, you know, in the margins of my book, and I was actually pleased to read these two books by Sunyi and Dombrenko, because they confirmed my suspicion. He was actually a pretty good communicator, even though the received wisdom is precisely the opposite. That, I mean, he spoke Russian with a heavy accent. He wasn't much seen or heard in public after a certain point in his life, and he had this sometimes quite kind of leaden syllogistic way of expressing himself, especially in print. But this was actually what was called for, I think, in a lot of the audiences that he was trying to get through to. The other thing is that he was able to play the kind of authentic kind of proletarian card at times, even though he wasn't really by occupation a proletarian. But he was capable of kind of talking rough to workers and contrasting his own roughness with the kind of highfalutin theories of some of his opponents. So he was quite versatile and by no means ineffective, because you've got to realise, and this is one of Sunyi's great achievements, that Marxism was what everyone was talking. There's a certain kind of what we might consider to be jargon or arid theoretical debates that are very burning issues for this particular group of people. And the way he expressed himself, worked a lot of the time, not all of the time. And there are examples in Sunyi's book where he loses debates against Menshevik opponents, for example. But still, he's far, far more effective as a communicator and even as a speaker than people have imagined.
Sunyi's book takes us up to 1917, and from there we have to do an almighty kind of pole vault to land in the time frame tackled by Yevgeny Dobrenko. Is it a problem that neither book covers the period from the revolution to the Second World War, the period that we mostly think of when we think of Stalin?
Well, I think it's refreshing in some ways. It forces us to ask one or two new questions and see Stalin from a slightly unfamiliar perspective. And of course, the question that I was asking myself, like any reviewer who's got more than one book to read, is how do I draw a connection between the two? And I think one connection might be this issue of Stalin's kind of pragmatism and flexibility, and another is this question of nation and empire, because he came of age in an imperial borderland and marinated in Georgian cultural nationalism as an adolescent, but then quickly grew out of it and became a a Marxist. But De Brinker makes the point, I think, and it's, you know, very, very, very powerfully, that the revolution of 1917 didn't resolve at all the question of what this Bolshevik country that eventually, in due course, became the Soviet Union, was going to be like. Was it going to become a nation of its own? And if there was a Soviet nation in the works, it was precisely a work in progress through the 20s and 30s. And De Brinker's argument is it's not really until after the war, taking advantage of the enormous legitimacy that victory in war confers on Stalin personally and the Soviet system in general, that this Soviet nation really comes together.
And by the time we catch up with Stalin in this book, then it's 1945, as you say, the Second World War has ended. He has this incredibly pressing task now of deciding how to absorb and shape the memory, I suppose, of the Second World War in order to help him build the state that he is presumably already, we think, thinking about. Is it clear that this was a sort of a one-man mission, or how was he interacting with the people around him in this time?
Well, certainly the idea that Stalin should come right to the centre of war memory, and in fact Stalin should supplant the memory of the war as a general social experience, that comes in pretty early. But what I think De Brinker shows is that Stalin's very able at intervening in debates that may seem abstruse and sending signals that get, you know, picked up by those around them, keeping people on their toes. And this is very striking, that it's hard to tell in advance what Stalin's position is going to be on something, whether he's going to be very offended by something, not offended at all.
There's a great thing you refer to in your piece. You call it textual anxiety, which I thought was
yes,
very good.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's not my phrase. It's the record phrase, but it's a good phrase. Yes. So Stalin has that quality of flexibility, and it's something about him, and it's something perhaps also about Bolshevism. This combination of extreme pragmatism, flexibility, along with doctrinal rigidity, or some semblance of doctrinal rigidity, the idea that almost being kind of ruthless and pragmatic is itself a principle of being a Bolshevik, and all of this, of course, wedded to a kind of supposedly scientific theory of how history unfolds and how society, economy, and politics operate.
Where does the nationalism come in then? You refer to his ethno-nationalism, and I was interested in kind of the extent to which it's comparable to the ethno-nationalism of say, Hitler, or whether it's a kind of very different sort of beast.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly it's a very, very different beast. And De Brinker comes close to saying that this Soviet nationalism that you get in the second half of the 40s and onwards is sort of Russian nationalism, ethnically Russian. And I mean, I think there's a lot in that. It's certainly, you know, Russo-centric. But I think Stalin, I mean, this is the kind of connection perhaps between the two books, that Stalin grew up in an imperial borderland, and he regarded himself as the inheritor of this empire when everything fell into place for him, and he became general secretary, and he didn't want to let it fall apart. And so he needed to find a recipe to keep it together. I think he's quite, pragmatic. He's not a doctrinaire on anything, and he certainly doesn't have some sort of Russian messiah complex or equivalent to anything Hitler had. But what was striking is he's not a Georgian nationalist, but for sure he sheds that quite early on in his life. And he's looking for a recipe that will, a kind of ideological recipe, a kind of imperial nationalism that will hold this state to together, provide the glue. And, the solution, yes, the solution is a kind of Russian-infused, statist Soviet nationalism bolstered by victory in the war. And, De Brinker argues this really kind of comes together in the late 40s.
And does De Brinker's book take us right up until the end?
The main focus is on that late Stalin period, 1945 to 1953. But he also makes you know, very interesting argument that this statist, anti-Western, you know, Russocentric nationalism has set the tone, basically, for all of subsequent Russian history. And in that light, you know, the Gorbachev period, the Yeltsin period, they're just blips. And you know, normal services resumed under Putin. That's the drift of it. In the review, I was just a kind of teeny bit kind of more cautious here. I mean, I think because Stalin looms so large, and that experience of Stalinism looms so large in 20th century Russian history, it's very tempting to draw a straight line from that to just about everything else. But the thing that strikes me is that this Soviet nation, in all sorts of ways, remained a work in progress, even at Stalin's death. And you know, Stalinism, the Stalinist rule had imposed enormous human costs on the society, and a lot of healing needed to be done. You know, quite simply, the state needed to offer its people a lot more than it had done in the Stalin period, and that is what the post-Stalin era is about, and the creation of a more meaningful welfare state than it ever existed in the Stalin period. So it seems to me that really this period of you know the coming of age of this Soviet nation may not really have happened until 15, 20 years after the death of Stalin.
And what would you say then on a final note? What would you say, you know, if you stopped the man on the street in Russia, what would you say his or her impression of Stalin and Stalinism would be, or the two things perhaps are separate? But what would be the general kind of view?
Well, I think that what is sometimes hard for people in the West to realise is that our notion of Stalin is very much focused on the terror, the absolutely dreadful things that he was responsible for from the late 20s through to the late 30s. And he was responsible for some very dreadful things after that as well. But also, of course, there's World War II. So I think, by contrast, the Russian associations would be much more with war. And whatever errors, blunders, even crimes that Stalin may have committed over the course of the war, somehow, you know, the victory, and this was the whole point of Stalinist ideology in 1945, you know, victory justified everything. And then Dobrynko also has a point that Stalin is associated with the early Cold War, standing up for Russian interests, both vis-a-vis the West and kind of on a global scale.
Well, Stephen Lovell, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on the show, why the Home Office must be held to account for the distorted version of British history that it expects would-be citizens to imbibe, and is literary self-help more subversive and, in fact, serious than we tend to give it credit for?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, and before we turn with interested scepticism to literary self-help, Toby Lichtig Would you like to shed some light on this week's back page, on the MB column, please?
I would, indeed. So the wonderful MC, our diarist, has drawn attention to a speech that Lord Blunkett, David Blunkett, the former Labour Home Secretary under Tony Blair, recently gave to the House of Lords, in which he cited the TLS. And the piece in question was by Frank Trentiman. It appeared in the edition of November the 3rd, and it concerned the Life in the UK test, which all prospective candidates for UK citizenship are required to take. And it was a very, very good piece. And it dissects not only how the test is filled with unfortunate historical errors and some really weird things, but sort of more sinisterly in various editions, as it has evolved over the years, it has become more jingoistic and less pluralistic. Trentiman refers to a distortion of the past that does violence to our basic understanding of history and raises fundamental questions for a liberal society. And one of the really interesting things about this is it was David Blunkett himself who helped to usher in the first test about 17 years ago. And he himself decried the outrageous anomalies in the present version. Things like the slave trade goes from being described as evil to booming. D-Day invasion of mainland Europe was described as a British invasion rather than an Allied invasion. We are drawn to the fact that slavery was made illegal in Britain in the 18th century, which it wasn't. There's a celebration of the orderly transition away from empire to Commonwealth under Britain, with no mention of partition, for example. And I could go on and on. It's a very alarming story, actually. And it's great that Trentiman wrote that piece for us, and it's really good that it's had political traction and that it is being talked about in the Lords.
And it's especially important now because the chapter in particular that he's pulling apart so well is the chapter entitled A Long and Illustrious History. And this didn't used to be something that people were tested on. Other things you would be tested on, I think you would choose a topic on British culture to talk about. And I know someone, in fact, our former colleague Maren Meinhardt wrote a beautiful piece about having to make a presentation on a good British cup of tea. but history did not used to be one of the things that people were tested on and expected to answer questions on. And so now what we have is a government setting out the record, and you have to give them the answers that they want to hear.
Yeah, setting out and editing the record, and it doesn't seem like there's much room for nuance. And there are some aspects of British history that can be celebrated, but it does seem to gloss out or gloss over some very important things, and particularly as they were there originally, it just seems all the more unpleasant. And Trenton makes the point that this editing of history seems to kind of dovetail with the Home Office policy of hostile environments. And I find it worrying, personally.
And so there is, there's a letter that Frank Trentman started way back in July, I think it is. He coordinated this open letter from historians calling on the Home Office to review this official and mandatory text because of the way it especially misrepresents slavery and decolonization. Another thing that we haven't mentioned actually, Toby, is that it seems to completely change the nature of the start of the Second World War. There is no mention of appeasement, for example, none at all.
Yes, the Munich Agreement gets edited out.
The Munich Agreement of 1938 disappears.
And weirdly, sort of Hitler's race theories and anti-Semitism disappears as well. So it was just all about his desire for more land.
But no mention of the Holocaust at all.
No. Not sure where that went and why. And another thing was the deaths of slaves during the Middle Passage. They've gone. The deaths have been taken.
There were 3.2 million at least, and now there are none mentioned.
There have been over 500 signatories to the letter now, haven't there?
Yeah, and it's still going, in fact. I think it's open to all historians. It says, so it's hosted on the Historical Association, which is a professional body that is non-partisan, as is the group of signatories to the letter. So you can find it. It's Googleable. It allows any historian at any stage of their career to add their name to the list, this list that is calling for the government to take another look, to withdraw it pending inquiry, basically. I think now, actually, it's more than 600 signatories.
It remains unanswered, doesn't it?
It remains unanswered, which is in fact, I think I've called it a debate somewhere in my introduction, but there is no debate because no one from the other side, as it were, is saying anything about it at all, which is baffling. So let's hope Lord Blunkett's fellow peers make the time to read Frank Trentman's essay. If they cannot afford the subscription, I will send them a copy personally.
Now, all that talk of citizenship and how to be an upstanding new member of British society brings us with perhaps only a few scenes showing to our next topic, which is the self-help book. Long derided by literary purists, self-help is a hugely lucrative corner of the publishing industry, with its bestsellers shifting copies in the many millions, classics of diagnosis and prescriptions such as How to Win Friends and Influence People or The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. But what are the origins of this so-called shadow genre? And could all literature in some way be labelled self-help, given what novels and poetry are able to teach us about life? Joanna Scutts has reviewed two books about this subject, and she joins me and Thea now. Hello, Joanna.
Hello, lovely to be here.
I guess we should start with the basics. What is self-help? How would you define it?
Well, that's a much more difficult question than it sounds. And I think we all have a sort of a hazy sense, as you said, of these kind of big bestsellers, which are sort of ways to achieve success and kind of overcome adversity and often a sort of financial or a career success is kind of implied or directly built in there. But there's the genre is, as you say, huge and sort of really, if you look at the publishing industry, it's sort of taking over all these other areas. So you have lots of these books that are sort of ostensibly about, I guess, design or about sort of lifestyle topics that are also in a way kind of how to fix your life books. You also have kind of big ideas, philosophy, politics books that also sort of boil down to how to be a better person, how to be a better citizen or a member of a community. So I think the idea of improving yourself is sort of at the core of all of these books, but it's very hard to pin down and not helped by the fact that a lot of books deny that they're self-help because it's got such a sort of this hucksterish reputation.
It seems to me like quite a contemporary phenomenon, the self-help book, or at least a sort of a facet of late capitalism, but it's got a bit more of a history than we might expect. Is that right?
Yes. Again, it comes back to how you define it, but certainly the genre that we recognize as a kind of anyone can do it, follow the advice in this book, and you, whoever you are, wherever you are, can be successful in a sort of capitalist society. The Victorians were big on this kind of genre. And Beth Bloom in her book identifies Samuel Smiles' book, Self-Help, as a kind of beginning of this genre, which as a kind of compendium of stories of success. And she sort of describes it as a fairly mind-numbing catalogue of stories of men who came from humble origins who became professional lawyers or other kind of elevated members of society through just their own sheer grit and hard work. So it's got that kind of up by the bootstraps feel.
And it's impressive or scary, depending on which way you wish to see it, how quickly that book in particular, Samuel Smiles' book, became a kind of authority. You mention how it was adopted in 1870s Japan as a kind of cheat sheet to Western civilization.
Yes, that's fascinating that he quotes a lot of literary works in that book. And this is a sort of part of how self-help and literature have always been connected, because part of being elevating yourself socially means kind of faking your way to an elite education. And so this book sort of was a shortcut by kind of naming this is the canon of great works that you should at least be familiar with. And as you say, when this kind of migrated to Japan, as it was sort of opening up in its modern era, it was kind of like, well, these are the ones we have to translate. This is the canon that clearly is approved. And so, you know, it's one of these interesting distinctions that certain authors got kind of elevated to a global canon and others are forgotten as sort of an arbitrary selection that becomes the veneer of authority, kind of sets it in stone.
Given how popular the Smiles book was at the time, was there a snobbery towards it? Did people review it cruelly and talk about it in disparaging terms?
I mean, I think that kind of disparagement is always a part of anything that's enormously popular. And I think there certainly was, worry about this. I think as with anything that seems to provide a shortcut to jumping the social ladder, there's certainly a sense that this was kind of a fake, this idea that you're faking it. and there's always this sort of anxiety, I think, certainly that comes from people who've much more sort of entrenched in that elite class system who definitely look down on anyone who's trying to sort of jump the queue. So I think that, yes, I think it was treated a little bit skeptically, but it was such a juggernaut that it kind of, you know, those critical voices get drowned out. I mean, critics hate nothing more than enormously popular books that won't won't be silenced by even really good objections. And I think we see that, I think that doesn't change.
It's interesting as well that you say, you point out how this highbrow hostility towards self-help has its own history that entwines it with the rise of literary studies as an academic discipline.
Right. I thought, you know, I think that's fascinating. We kind of tend to forget that literary studies or studying English at university was something that had to be invented and had to be justified, because reading books in English as opposed to in Latin or Greek has always had a bit of a sort of sordid reputation. You know, we all know sort of the history of novel reading as this kind of very disreputable pursuit, and especially for ladies. And so the idea of studying literature, you know, I think it's the same, a version of the same snobbery you had sort of 20 odd years ago when media studies was first a degree program. You know, that sort of sneer that accompanied that, I think, was not dissimilar to the sneers about English literature as a degree. So part of the process of justifying that study really required saying that the poetry and novels in English were worthy of study. So it's a kind of interesting historical coincidence that probably isn't a coincidence at all, but it's they're entwined in a very interesting way, I think.
One of the things that I've often wondered about, the kind of the more traditional self-help books, the books that say what we need to do is, you know, jog more or eat more healthily or tidy our rooms more frequently, is that it can almost be more about the symptoms and the disease, and these kind of quick fix solutions can make us feel responsible for our own suffering rather than the kind of broader context in which we live. Like, you know, all we need to do is tidy our room to feel better rather than address systemic inequality and injustice and things like that. I wonder, I mean, there's a really interesting bit in your piece when you talk about the ways in which the self-help book can actually be countercultural, even perhaps anti-capitalist. And I just wondered if you could say a little bit about that, because I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the traditional self-help, the sort of critique that I think does have some merit is that it does insist that your problems and therefore their solutions begin with you. You may not be surprised to learn that Margaret Thatcher was a big fan of Samuel Smiles and at one point wanted every school child in Britain to be given a copy. But the idea that it's entwined with a kind of individualistic solutions to problems is very well entrenched. It's a huge genre that historically in the 20th century exploded with the Depression in America, and most of the very famous titles, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Life Begins at 40, these things begin, really can be dated from the mid-30s. Whereas obviously the solution to America's economic depression wasn't for people to work harder. The idea of it as a countercultural sort of force is, I think it's best summed up in the idea of sort of living well as the best revenge, right? The idea that, well, if you are someone who's counted out by society, who's not expected because of your class or race to really be prominent and successful, to kind of find that in yourself and become something unexpected, there is a kind of defiance to that. So I think a lot of books, certainly kind of recently have tried to tap into that and suggest it as a kind of a form of sort of cultural resistance.
Lest anyone start to think that the genre, insofar as there is one, is Anglo-centric, you know, that it's something that is really actually taken off and become a big business in America. It sounds like Beth Blum's book offers a kind of corrective to that. It's a global community.
Yeah, she has some fascinating examples of the ways in which these titles and these lessons get translated and sort of circulated far beyond their origins. And yeah, the Americanness of the genre, I think, is I think is because of the way it's tied up with capitalism. But obviously capitalism is not just an American phenomenon by any stretch. So these books she's talking about, has examples of these wonderful, these sort of DIY kind of how-to pamphlets that are published in Nigeria and sold in markets. And they're a vernacular sort of version of it, but it's still this idea of kind of the idea, I think, at some level that everybody is looking for the same thing. Everybody wants love and happiness and money, and how you put those things together and how you order them varies. But wherever you are in the world, the idea of getting more of those things is pretty appealing.
I think in the Nigerian case, and I was just thinking this earlier because we ran a review a couple of months ago of a book by L. Nathan John called Becoming Nigerian, A Guide. And that in itself sort of riffed on an earlier book by Peter Enohoro from the 60s, which was called How to Be a Nigerian. And in both cases, it's a satirical take on the self-help genre, which is a whole other spin.
Yes, I think there's a huge popularity of works whose titles riff on those classic self-help books. You know, you can look for that. That's its own little subgenre now of, you know, there's a power in sort of giving up on measuring your success and your improvement and tracking everything that you do and just kind of saying, throwing up your hands and trying to say, well, I'm a messy human and that's okay.
A lot of these ideas are explored in the Beth Blum book, The Self-Help Compulsion, but you've also reviewed another book, Reading for Life by Philip Davis. And I just wondered where he's coming from. And you talk a little bit about the psychological and neurological impact of reading. What's his kind of take on sort of bibliotherapy?
Well, it's a fascinating approach. He's coming from an academic study, a background of a centre that is trying to bring together, as you say, neurology and psychology with literary study and trying to figure out what reading does for us and does to us. And he's specifically looking at the reading of what he calls serious literature. As I mentioned, that still kind of ends up being a fairly traditional white Western male canon. So I have a little hesitation about what we assume it to be serious about that. But given that, it's fascinating. His wife runs an outreach charity that does reading groups in institutional settings, in a lot of prisons and hospitals and childcare and care homes, essentially trying to, instead of therapy groups, the idea is that a group of people will come together and read a poem, read a short story, and read it together. So it's not a pre-digested encounter. It's kind of the idea that reading together and reading as in a sort of immediate form can have this kind of awakening impact on people who often have been in therapy for a long time, are very familiar with its kind of narrative strategies and sort of the idea that a poem, something unexpected, can kind of jolt people out of those expected narratives and come to something new. So it's a fascinating idea. And then he's trying to really sort of quantify and pin down what that effect is, how it works.
So I suppose it's kind of an adjunct to art therapy, isn't it? I mean, there are all sorts of different ways of being in therapy. I know someone who does weaving in therapy, for example, or clay modelling and things like that. And I've never really kind of thought about the way in which literature can be brought in a similar manner.
I think the important difference is that it's reading. It's not creative writing. It's not having people write their own stories. It's having them read and respond. So I guess the kind of...
But the response is the creativity, yes, isn't it? It's the kind of the reading of that text is that kind of creativity.
Yeah, but it's sort of saying, you know, I think that he's just very interested in whether there's something that that kind of happens neurologically or happens psychologically, that the idea is that it's a surprise. It's a sort of jolt out of established patterns, a jolt of recognition that somebody writing 150 years ago is articulating the same kinds of problems that you are struggling with as an alcoholic. And his method in the book is to look through transcripts of these sessions and sometimes to interview people and sort of really try to dig into what it is about their reading and this discovery process that changes them.
It's empathy, I would imagine, a lot of it. And that's sort of, you know, that blurring the boundaries between us and other people, which is, I guess, what literature does at its best and what art does at its best. But also, I guess that's where kind of therapy comes in as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what all of this ends up kind of circling around is this challenge of, are we, you know, if we improve ourselves, are we improving the world in some way? Is there a connection between thinking about ourselves and making ourselves better and sort of that step outwards and that, as you say, empathy for others and perhaps that sense of community? And critics of self-help as a genre sort of complain that it turns people inwards, I think, and that stops them from looking outwards. But there is another argument that, in fact, you know, literature can, through empathy, I think, can open our eyes to what's around us.
The thing that worries me, or that irks me, I guess, about the idea of bibliotherapy is just the idea that a book can be prescribed for something, that anyone can really know how another person will react or what they will find in a book. That to me just seems like it risks reducing the book to something. But maybe this is exactly the kind of snobbery that needs to be pushed back against.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I agree with you to an extent that the idea of a novel cure or a book can be prescribed does seem very reductive. But at the same time, I think what we end up sort of coming back around to is the idea that if we think reading is valuable, perhaps it's better to focus our energies on helping people read better, helping children learn how to read more freely, how to read more confidently and creatively and broadly, and not constantly trying to sort of reduce their reading experience to certain books. Instead of trying to quantify what is or isn't good about reading, perhaps focusing our attention on raising voracious readers is maybe where the energy should be going. You know, bibliotherapy, as you say, is one approach, but perhaps, you know, it should be one among many.
So I suppose one person's prescription is another person's recommendation or even inspiration. And I guess the bibliomemoir at its best is just a way of people trying to inspire others in what's worked for them and what they think is wonderful, and you know, not to wish to sound too capitalist about it, but selling art and selling what it is that's so life affirming, which I think is probably a nice way to end. So thank you very much for joining us, Joanna Scutts.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the piece, and it was great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Stephen Lovell and Joanna Scutts. You'll find all the pieces we've discussed today on our website, the-tls.co.uk, along with countless others. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Lee Meyer. We'll be back next week for the last episode of the year. But for now, from Toby Lichtig and from me, goodbye.